You are now listening to the eWatchman Podcast with your host, Robert Gates.
Hello and welcome to the August 2014 edition of the Watchman's Post podcast. Special greeting to ex-Jehovah's Witnesses and lurking elders, CIA spooks, and Ukrainian hackers. Welcome, everyone. Well, at the format of this program, if you've heard before, you no doubt know that I entertain questions from you, the listeners. Some questions I pop into the mailbag, and others I entertain on the monthly podcast. I have a question. Someone asked what would be the scriptural justification for preparing physically for the upheaval of the tribulation. As you may or may not know, Jehovah's Witnesses consider it a demonstration of a lack of faith if someone were to, say, store food or other things for a time of upheaval. It would demonstrate that they lacked faith in Jehovah's saving power. And that point was emphasized this year. I made mention of the fact I attended a session of this year's district convention in Detroit, and the governing body speaker, he denigrated the preppers and, you know, scoffed at them. But I don't know why the society would feel impelled to dictate to Jehovah's Witnesses in this matter, because the scriptures really don't say anything about it. There are certain principles that could come to play. For example, the proverb says that the shrewd one sees the calamity coming and he proceeds to conceal himself, whereas the inexperienced one goes headlong and suffers the penalty. Well, that's an apt principle to apply. And personally, I am in favor of having a few things set aside, not for necessarily Armageddon, but for whatever may come. Some of you may have experienced the massive blackout about 10 years ago. It affected the northeastern part of the United States and Canada. I was living in Detroit at the time, and well, just ask yourself, what would you do right at this very moment if suddenly the power went out? You think about it. Well, you sit there for a minute, maybe in the dark, and I wonder how long it will be before the lights come back on. If it's in the winter, how long will it be before the furnace blower comes back on? Or in the summer, how long will it be before the freezer comes back on and the refrigerator comes back on? It's full of food that will perish in a few days. And maybe you're on a dialysis machine or something, you know. It's a very real thing. We are so dependent upon the electrical grid. And as it turned out, the power in that particular blackout, I think it was 2003, maybe four, it was off for almost a week, 5 days. And so it created quite a bit of problems. And let's say that, you had relatives in another part of the country that had power. You're going to drive over there, but your gas tank was empty. So you go down to the station, and there's a two-mile line because it's the only station with, a generator capable of pumping the gas. So, I mean, we take all these modern conveniences for granted, but they're all tied into an electrical grid, aren't they? And so I think it's wise to have something set aside. This past week, I was visited with a disaster along with hundreds of thousands of other Michiganders, specifically people living in Detroit and some of the cities round about, Royal Oak and Huntington Woods and Warren. And it rained 5 inches a couple of weeks ago, which is not a whole lot. I mean, I used to live in Texas. That's just an average, you know, rainfall for the afternoon in the summer. But because the city of Detroit has been bankrupted by Wall Street, and I won't get into the derivative swindle that it was behind that, but take my word for it. So the city can't maintain their pumps. And two of their sewage pumps failed at a critical time. And people say, well, Detroit was flooded. Well, that's not really an accurate description. It was inundated with sewage. And the sewage was under such pressure, it pushed back up through the pipes and came gushing up through the drains in people's basements. And it was like a geyser of raw sewage. Our place was filled with about 4 feet of sewage. And hundreds of other homes were as well. And yes, I did have some things set aside for a rainy day, but how ironic that my little bag of rice and beans was under 4 feet of sewage, and it was in there for a few days because I couldn't get to it, and so it was all swollen up. It was quite a mess. I had to get in there with hip boots and a gas mask and a shovel. That's why I haven't been posting on my website for the past week dealing with this disaster. And all of my neighbors, I mean, we had to rip everything out of our basements, piled it up on the curbside. And of course, the trash pickup was overwhelmed and lost everything in the basement. Fortunately, I got my computer out a few months before and my good microphone that I'm speaking through now. But I lost some other electronic equipment, and the furnace was ruined, the water heater, washer. The washer was floating face down. Oh, man. But the point is, my preparation, I had a little crank-up shortwave radio, you know, that was ruined. So that's the disadvantage of having a little stockpile. But on the other hand, it would be better to have something and lose it than not have anything and really need something. And especially if you have, I think, special needs or children or others that you provide for and have to think about. It's not just about us. I have my stuff and you ain't going to get it. Well, you know, in the Christian era of the first century, Paul encouraged congregations to set something aside every week for those in need. And a pickup was arranged. But Jerusalem at that time was under a famine. And so the brothers throughout the Mediterranean region were encouraged to set something aside for them that was delivered to them on a weekly basis. So that was Jehovah's provision for caring for them, that brothers and sisters set something aside for others. You know, so it's not just all about us surviving. And the person asked, well, what about having a go bag? The United States government recommends that, and I think even the society mentioned something about it, to be ready for, not necessarily the Great Tribulation, but for these unexpected disasters that are seemingly weather-related disasters, earthquakes and so forth. We're all subject to these catastrophes. Why not be a little bit prepared and think ahead? That's what wisdom is, isn't it? Seeing something that's not right before you, but is a possibility. So I think you have to use common sense. There's no point in having a warehouse full of food. And it's like Jesus said, you know, would I let the man on the rooftop not come down and go into his house, and let the man in the field not return to the city? So there will come a time when these catastrophe overtakes the entire inhabited world, and our faith and trust had better be in Jehovah. But that doesn't rule out either having something. It wouldn't be a bad idea to have some coins. Silver is fairly cheap now, and they may confiscate gold, but what are they going to do, confiscate grandma's silverware, you know? I mean, it's not likely. But thank you for that question, though, and it's certainly something to think about. I have a series of questions here from a person that is studying with Jehovah's Witnesses, and he asks some basic questions, which are really the bedrock, the foundation of the truth. And so I'm happy to consider these. His first question is, why did Satan turn against Jehovah? And we can't know exactly his thinking, and I don't really want to anyway, but the scriptures do make mention of the fact that Satan was taken with his own beauty and his own wisdom. The Apostle Paul alluded to that as well when he said not to appoint a newly converted man to the office of elder for fear that he should become puffed up with pride and fall into the judgment passed along upon the devil. So that's why the devil was condemned, because of his pride. See, the devil was put into a position of oversight, wasn't he? He was like the overseer of the Garden of Eden. He was God's representative. And it's not that he so much turned against Jehovah. I'm sure he loved Jehovah, but he loved himself more. And that's really the temptation we're all faced with, isn't it? Because when something we want goes counter to what God wants, then we're tempted to go against God. And the love of God means obeying his commandments, right? So when we want something that is against God's will, then if we go with that, then we show that we love ourselves more than we love Jehovah. And Satan was so full of himself, and he saw how Adam and Eve worshiped and adored Jehovah, what they knew of him, and he felt like he wanted that adoration for himself because he was just as wise and beautiful as Jehovah himself, right? And he's made in God's image, so he coveted the worship that belonged exclusively to Jehovah. And he schemed and came up with a way to receive that worship. And he was successful. And why did Jehovah allow that? Well, because we're all, those of us of intelligent creation, made in God's image, we are free moral agents. Unlike the animals, they're simply programmed to behave in a certain way. They have no real choice. I mean, you know, they have instinctive behavior that dictates to them generation after generation how they will behave. They have no choice. But we do. And it has to be that way because Jehovah wants us to love him. And love has to be voluntary. We can choose to love and obey God or not. And so Satan chose not to. And Jehovah allowed him, but now we have to suffer the consequences of his selfish choice. But in the end, Jehovah will reverse everything that Satan has wrought and bring him to absolute nothingness. It will be as though what he did never occurred, except Jehovah will have been glorified even more so in the way that he's handled it, and the way that his purpose will be accomplished in spite of anything that Satan and his demons have done. I think going back to the pre-flood world, I get the feeling that you know, the angels, Jehovah had never really destroyed anyone, as far as we know, any of his sons. And I think the angels may have felt like he was just too kind-hearted. You know, we as humans, we often take advantage of kind-hearted people. Our parents may be overly indulgent, and they hated to punish us as a child. And so maybe we became spoiled, and we would take advantage of their soft-heartedness. And I think maybe that was the way that some of the angels felt. And when the rebellion started, and they thought, hey, let's get in on this and go down and marry these beautiful women, and we can be worshipped like these rock star gods. And so that's what they did. Jehovah allowed them to do it. But then the hammer fell. The sky fell, and Jehovah opened up the underground waters, and he created this deluge that destroyed the world, and it also drowned those rebellious angels' beautiful wives, and it drowned their sons. And I think that's what really, the warfare began then. The question was, why did Satan turn against Jehovah? Now they wanted revenge because Jehovah really used his power against them. And then when they dematerialized back into the spirit, then he put the clamps on them. And so now they are absolute enemies of Jehovah and of anyone who is friends with Jehovah, which includes us. Here's another question here. Why does Jehovah use blood sacrifices for forgiveness? Well, the book of Leviticus is all about the sacredness of blood and the use of blood in sacrifice. Blood simply represents our life, our soul. And so Jehovah, because humans have become imperfect, God requires a sacrifice of a perfect soul to buy back humanity, and that would include pouring out their blood. So the animal sacrifices demonstrated that. And then when Christ came, he was the Lamb of God, the sacrificial scapegoat, you might say, and he poured out his blood, his soul. That's what the scripture says. He poured out his soul to the very death. And he bled when they put the crown of thorns on his head. He bled when they scourged him with a whip. And he certainly bled when they drove the nails into his hands and feet. And he bled specifically when the army guard jabbed a spear into his side. And it says water and blood came out. So that blood is what Jehovah accepts, the sacred blood of Christ, in our behalf to cover our sinful blood, you might say. Now, this is another interesting question here. Why did Jehovah have to send his son and not use another angel as the sacrifice? Well, for one thing, all of the angels are God's sons. They're called the sons of God. In fact, in what I alluded to, the rebellious angels that came down, Genesis chapter 6 refers to them as the sons of God. But the one who came to the earth was Jehovah's beloved son, his firstborn son, and you might say his favorite son. And humans have favorite sons and daughters too, don't they? Not necessarily their first, but in the case of Jehovah, it was his first. Let me address this point. Before I get into this, why was it necessary for God to even send anyone from heaven? Well, this goes back to Satan maneuvering things so that he could be God. Because he, in his pride and imagined wisdom, he thought he could really checkmate God and put him into an impossible position where God would have to break his word in order to accomplish his purpose. Now, going back to the Garden of Eden, God made three public statements, basically, of his intent and purpose. When he created Adam and Eve, he told them to fill the earth and subdue it, right? And so God was entrusting them with finishing his purpose to have the earth a paradise and filled with perfect people. God could have created them all individually, like, you know, an assembly line, cranking them out. But he gave Adam and Eve the privilege of procreating and producing offspring. And that way God would fulfill his purpose. And then he told them, do not eat from this tree in the middle of the garden, this tree of knowledge, because if you do, you'll die. You'll positively die. And then God said he was resting. And he blessed the seventh day and made it sacred. And he's resting from all of his earthly creative work. And we can expect that at the end of that seventh day, God would review it like he did at the end of the other days and say it is very good. And at that point, the earth would be a beautiful paradise full of perfect people that all worship Jehovah. But then Satan seduced Eve and got her husband to follow, and we know what happened. They became sinful. Would Jehovah say, oh, no, I guess I have to let you off the hook. You won't die after all, because otherwise how will I, you know, fill the earth with people? Or if he puts them to death immediately, the earth is going to be unpopulated. The animals would just run wild, right? Or if God turned around and created two new Adam and Eves, let's get rid of these two, let's try again, then God would be violating his own Sabbath because he said he was resting from his creation. So Satan figured, either way you go, I've got him here. He'll break his word one way or the other, and I can prove he's a liar. But Jehovah's purpose is fulfilled by allowing a sinful Adam and Eve to produce offspring before they died, and they died within that 1,000-year day, as Jehovah said they would in the very day. And then Jehovah would provide a ransomer who lived outside the human realm originally. Jesus was not a new creation. He took his son from heaven, and because humans are just a little lower than angels, we're both made in the image of God originally, he could transfer that son and encode his personality into the DNA of Mary. And that way, his heavenly son could become part of the human family, but still retain his perfection. Because a materialized angel, I mean, there are many angels that materialized before Christ, and they looked and appeared human, but they were not integrated into the human family. But Jesus was. He was a Jewish son of God. And so Jehovah did not violate his Sabbath by creating a new earthly being. But as far as the question, why did he send this particular son and not use another angel as the sacrifice? Well, he could have, and I am certain that all of God's loyal angels would have been happy to serve Jehovah that way because they love him too, and they are obedient to him. They will do anything that Jehovah asked them to do. But it goes back to this challenge that Satan issued in the case of Job. And you know what Satan said, that, you know, a human man will do anything, skin in behalf of skin. A man will give anything in exchange for his soul. You know, I'll prove it. Let me just put the screws to Job. You'll see, he'll curse you to your very face. Well, it wasn't just about Job, was it? Satan was really impugning the integrity of every intelligent creation, including the angels, and including this firstborn son who had all the privileges. I think of the of human royalty, like the British monarchy, and just think, I mean, they have a privileged life. Just think if one of them had been asked to go down into the gutter and do some really nasty work for, you know, going to Calcutta and, you know, help the poor and not have any of the comforts that he was used to in Buckingham Palace or Windsor or whatever, you know. I mean, that's basically, Jesus was really the most privileged creature in all of God's creation because Jehovah used him in creation. But Jesus also had a special fondness for humanity because he was used in creation. And he loved Jehovah, was willing to give it all of his privilege up in heaven because he saw the need to accomplish Jehovah's purpose, to vindicate Jehovah as... And there's another aspect to this too, because Jehovah doesn't ask us to sacrifice and not reward us for our obedience. So Jehovah fully intended that if the son was obedient unto death, that he would give him his throne. And so he wanted his firstborn to have his throne, apparently, and to have all the power and authority that he has. And he fully trusted the son that the son would give it back. Unlike Satan, who's coveted Jehovah's power, Jehovah gives everything to Jesus. And what does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 15? At the end, he hands it back and subjects himself to the Father so that God may be all things to everyone, including the Son. So it shows that Jehovah is not holding anything back and that his creatures love Jehovah even though they're given everything and in a position where they don't even need Jehovah, like Jesus and the 144,000 will be, and yet they still worship Jehovah out of their love for him. Okay, his last question here. Why is Adam only guilty and not Eve? Because as it says, through one man sin entered and death through sin. Well, for one thing, Eve was guilty because she paid the penalty of sin. She died. So it wasn't that she was guiltless, but Paul did say she was thoroughly deceived. And apparently Adam wasn't. He knew that something wasn't quite right with this talking serpent. But again, he loved Eve more than he loved Jehovah. And, you know, humans are, again, we're subject to that too, aren't we? Jesus said, anyone who loves father and mother, brother, sister, wife, more than me is not worthy of me. And Adam was not worthy of Jehovah. He loved his wife more. There is a principle embodied in the Mosaic Law, and I didn't take the time really to look it up, but there was an aspect of the law that if a woman got into a contract that was not approved by her head, be it her father or her husband, that the father or husband could nullify it and make it null and void, whatever agreement she gotten into. And so, I mean, that's an interesting concept, that Adam was the head of Eve. Man is the head of woman, and Jehovah respects that. That's his arrangement. When Eve was seduced by this serpent and went to her husband, he had, for one thing, lived much longer than Eve. He was alone in the garden for apparently many years. Jehovah gave him the assignment of naming all of the animals. Just think of that. I mean, it was a very leisurely time, no hurry. Jehovah would bring him the animals. He would observe them and give them an appropriate name. And then at the end of that period, he put him to sleep and made his wife from his rib. And what did Adam exclaim? At last, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And he called her Eve. So he was alone and he knew Jehovah better than her. So here his wife comes with, you know, this fruit and says, hey, this serpent told me Jehovah's lying, he's trying to hold, you know, our eyes will be. Adam, he should have said, wait a minute, show me where this snake is. I've never heard any animal talk. What is going on? let's wait till Jehovah comes around and let's find out, because I'm not going to disobey God. He said, if you eat that, you'll die, and I believe him. Remember, it says Jehovah would stroll through the garden about the breezy part of the day, and apparently they spoke on a daily basis. Just think of that. If you could ask God any question, I mean, why did Adam disobey? I mean, he just said, Jehovah, what Eve got herself, what's going on here? It would have been over. Satan probably would have been crushed right then and there. And that would have been the end of it. And it's possible if Adam would have been faithful that Jehovah would have forgiven Eve. He could have nullified her sin because she was totally hoodwinked. I mean, she was naive. I mean, obviously, innocent and naive as could possibly be. You know, you've heard the expression, well, I wasn't born yesterday. Well, apparently she was. She had no experience. And that's why Satan targeted her. She was so trusting. I mean, who would talk to a snake? But, I mean, that was a different time and place, wasn't it? Okay, well, thank you so much for those questions. Here's a question I get frequently in different variations. He says, this question has been on my mind lately. In order for a person to be saved during Armageddon, do they have to be part of the JW organization? If so, could you please support it with Bible scriptures? Well, that's not such a simple question to answer, because when we consider the JW organization is basically the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, it's not going to be there come the Great Tribulation and Armageddon, or what is left of it during that time will be a misleading influence. And as I've sort of been the focus of my work to prepare the few for what is ahead, the big test of faith for Jehovah's Witnesses will be to leave the Watchtower Society, because Jehovah will then set up something else, the kingdom, and the faithful will be ushered into it. Now, be that as it may, what does the scripture say? Before that day comes upon you, before the burning anger of Jehovah is poured out, seek Jehovah, seek meekness, seek righteousness. Perhaps you may be concealed in the day of Jehovah's anger. So how do we seek Jehovah? Are Jehovah's Witnesses as an organization doing that? I would say absolutely. Absolutely, no question about it. And what is Jehovah's will? Jesus said, you know, many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name, expel demons in your name? And Jesus will say, get away from me, you workers of lawlessness. Only those who are doing his Father's will enter into the kingdom. So what is Jehovah's will? Well, he wants us to be part of a congregation. There is a congregation. That congregation is going to be judged, but it's also Jehovah's will that we preach. The Watchtower organization makes it easy to do that so that you have a ministry that it has a training program and gives you materials and a platform and a way to go about having a meaningful ministry so that we can seek Jehovah in that way. Seeking meekness would, you know, involve humbling ourselves and being taught, subjecting ourselves to an elder arrangement. Just because it's going to be judged doesn't mean it's not Jehovah's arrangement, does it? So you figure that out for yourself, considering everything the Bible says and considering what the organization has provided. You figure out if you need to be part of that organization or associated with it in some way in the periphery, as I am and many others are. Okay, here someone asked me about the parable of Lazarus and the rich man in the 16th chapter of Luke. He says, I've always wondered why it seems to depict heaven and hell, even though I know these places to exist in a different sense than what Christendom believes them to be. What's the significance? Okay. He says, please help me to reason upon this parable as soon as you can. Well, admittedly, it seems if we just read that parable disconnected from the Bible as a whole, it may lead, yes, you can see why people would accept that as, you know, the rich man was, but it doesn't say he's in heaven, does it? It says he's in the bosom position with Abraham. But, of course, when we take the Bible as a whole, we know that Hades is not a fiery inferno. It's depicted that way in this parable alone. In fact, Hades is thrown into the lake of fire, right? In Revelation, it's destroyed. Jesus was in Hades, right? He was in hell for 3 days. Jehovah resurrected him. He was dead. He came back to life. So it's not a fiery place. Well, you know, in Thessalonians, where Paul referred to God allowing a deluding influence to go to those who know the truth, and I've pointed out how this applies to the invisible parousia and all of that connected with 1914, but it seems to me that Jehovah also allows an operation of error or a deluding influence to go to everyone who approaches the Bible. And, for example, John 1:1. I mean, that's, how many times have you heard a Trinitarian, oh, Jesus, God, says right there, JW's got their own Bible. And anybody who's really looked into this can see that John 1:1 does not support the Trinity or even that Jesus being God. But, you know, why did God allow it to be worded in such a way so that in the translation it could be worded the way it is, that makes it seem as if it's saying Jesus is God, the God? Why did God allow that? Well, because he wants people to, well, what was the verse in Zephaniah? Seek Jehovah. Seek the truth. Don't accept these surface things that are handed out by, you know, these con artists, clergymen. But if you want to believe it, there you go. Hell is a hot place. Jehovah's going to torture and burn everyone for eternity. And there's the scriptural proof for it. Luke 16. So I think that's why God allows it, to give people what they want. They want to believe a lie. Here you go. Okay. Last question here. It's involving the King of the North and South. He says, I have a question I feel is valid. Can you help me understand how the sword stroke of the seventh head of the wild beast in Revelation corresponds to the pushing of the King of the North and South? In other words, how does the King of the North and South give rise to the eighth king? I'm having trouble understanding how, if the King of the North is Britain and the King of the South is the United States, and both have prophesied to get the sword stroke that gives rise to an eighth king representing a tyrannical world government that rules for the symbolic 1 hour. Okay. Well, I've written quite a bit, you know, on the King of the North and the South, and I would hope people would click on some of the links that go to some of the articles on the internet describing these two systems that exist and that have existed for quite a while. Really, it goes back to the Renaissance and the beginning of the development of what we recognize now as nations, states, because prior to that time, there was the empire, and it ruled over this feudal system in Europe primarily. And we're talking about Europe because this Roman beast ruled primarily over Europe at that time, although since then it has become a global system. But gradually, men began to break away from this imperial, monarchical, oligarchic rule. And with the development of the United States and the Revolutionary War, then the Republican system became separate and distinct from an imperial system. So it's not simply Great Britain. Great Britain is simply the primary host of the empire. The empire is extranational. It seeks to control nations. Isn't that what, going back to the seventh chapter of Daniel, this beast with 10 horns, iron teeth, it crushes all the nations and tramples them down. That's what the empire seeks to do. It seeks to prevent nations from developing, prevent people from being educated, right? So it can keep them under its control. Whereas Jehovah has not really, abandoned mankind. And because we are made in the image of God, even though we're tarnished by sin, we still have the impulse to seek for freedom, to develop, to help others, to live a life that's, not under grinding poverty. And going back to the book of Daniel and the 10th chapter, it mentions that Jehovah's angel had stood up as a strengthener of the king of Persia. And so it seems evident that Jehovah's angel has strengthened certain forces and people at different times in history. And I believe, people say, well, God bless America. Well, I think he has in the past. Because, America was founded originally by those who were fleeing persecution of the Church of England and from the tyranny of the Church in Europe. I mean, they'd fought war after war, the Catholics and Protestants, and the Puritans were persecuted by everyone. Do you know it was mandatory in England that you had to go to the Church of England on Sunday, and if you didn't, you would be fined, penalized? So, the Puritans were seeking freedom for themselves, and the nation that they originally founded as 13 colonies developed, and the principles embedded in their Constitution and Bill of Rights were to allow for freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And so it provided a proper, seedbed for what would come eventually with the work of Jehovah's Witnesses now. But now that that work is completed, or nearly completed, Jehovah's angel is not going to stand as a strengthener anymore, right? In fact, Jehovah is going to acquisition his military force, which is the nations, the eighth king, and this empire, to bring about discipline and punishment, which is also part of his purpose, to prepare his people to inherit the world, to inherit the kingdom of heaven as well. But getting back to this king of the north and the south, the pushing is not what brings about the downfall of the king of the south. The king of the south is pushing back against the empire, which I think is being reflected now, not in any controversy between America and Great Britain, but between the American system and this British imperial system, which is reflected in primarily the monetary and financial system that has dominated the world. But the American system is, ironically enough, being promoted now by China and the BRICS, who are developing their nations in cooperation with each other. They're furthering scientific progress. They're going to the moon. America has virtually abandoned their space exploration, but the Chinese are going to mine helium-3 from the moon to pursue fusion reaction, which is a whole new level of source of energy, which could, if allowed to develop, completely transform human civilization. So anyway, this BRICS system stands poised to completely replace the bankrupt IMF system that the empire has used to crush the nations since the end of World War II. And the empire is simply not going to allow anyone else to rule the world. It will bring the whole system down. It will, launch a nuclear war and, eliminate the whole shebang rather than forfeit it to especially some group of people that are not Anglo-Saxon. So that's where we stand right now. The pushing, like I say, is not what brings down the King of the South. It's the flooding over. And that can take the form not necessarily of invading armies, but bringing the whole financial system down, unleashing their terrorist assets, like this ISIS now that's destroying Iraq and Syria, and who's, they basically created a new bin Laden boogeyman, and now U.S. officials are saying, oh, these guys are coming to get, they're going to unleash their terror in America, The United States, as a dupe of London, is financing, training, and equipping ISIS to destroy Syria, and at the same time bombing them in the neighboring country of Iraq. How insane is that? And yet, people just don't get it. They're so stupefied. And the media, obviously, doesn't do them any service either. So if this whole system comes down, how are people going to react? The Bible explains that it'll be begging and pleading for the mountains to fall over us and protect us. They will beg for any sort of government, even a tyrannical government, as opposed to no government and anarchy. And that's the whole purpose. So the empire will reinvent itself. Great Britain and the United States have been, this Anglo-American dual world power. They will reinvent themselves as the Eighth King, or promote the Eighth King, which probably in the form of the United Nations. But it won't be anything like what we have now with the freedoms that we enjoy and so forth. It will be a global tyranny, and probably communistic regime. Anyway, that's about it. My voice is going. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for your interests. And may Jehovah bless your search for the truth.